Hello again, this is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atzid and the Web Yeshiva with another installment in our Jewish History Series. Tonight, looking at the response to Reform Judaism and the emergence of Orthodoxy as we know it today. I mentioned last time that very often the name of a group, groups don't have the luxury of choosing their own names. Sometimes their names are given to them by the other groups or associations that they are formed in opposition to. And that's actually true with Orthodoxy as well. The term Orthodoxy, which literally means correct doctrine, dox is from the same root as doctrine. Correct beliefs was a term that was actually first used sarcastically by the reformers in the 1790s, around the 1790s. Prior to that time, I'm laughing, Barbara. I hope it was a joke. Neo-Zionist Haredi Chazon. Prior to that time, there was no need. When you're the only show in town, you don't need a name to define yourselves. They were just Jews. Jews were Jews, that's who they were. So in the 1790s, we have this term in German, which I can't promise that I won't butcher the pronunciation. If there's somebody with us that can do a better job, Gesetzestruh, which literally means, yeah. What is it, Esther? Can you help me out with that? No, so that's a term that comes later. But this term, which is just a literal German translation of orthodoxy, true beliefs. But it was used sarcastically by the reformers to refer to the Orthodox by way of saying they're the ones that think they have the true beliefs. And as the way these things happen, names stick. The idea that that there's one group which is, you know, true to halakha, or true to a certain interpretation of Judaism. During the Haskalah, during the nascent Jewish Enlightenment that we spoke about, you remember our discussions of Moses Mendelssohn and others. During the Haskalah, the polarization between maskilim and traditional Jews was not quite as strong as we see with the rise later of Reform, where you really have a division into different denominations, different Judaisms, you know, which has had tragic impact, regardless of which side of the divide you stand on in terms of splintering the Jewish community. In the 1830s, the Reform movement in Germany became much more active, not just in Germany, by the way, throughout Europe. The Reform, but the capital is always in Germany. The Reform movement becomes much more, militant, much more active. In 1838, there's a struggle between Abraham Geiger, who we spoke about last time, who's really, you know, one of the granddaddies of the Reform movement, over the rabbinate in the city of Breslau, where he was appointed, he was brought in as a deputy rabbi or an associate rabbi to the Rav of the city, whose name was Rav Titkin, who was a traditionalist. And this Rav Titkin is able to kind of suppress Geiger for quite a long time. he prevents him from being able to speak in the pulpit, and ultimately he's not able to stem the tide, and he himself, this Rav Titkin, finally has to resign, and Geiger is successful in turning Breslau into a center of the reforms. In the 1840s, there were those conferences of the reform movement in order to kind of set policy and doctrine on an array of issues. We spoke about that last time. And the response to the reform movement from the traditionalist camp, from this newly termed Orthodox camp, is initially headed by the Chatam Sofer, or the Chasam Sofer, as he would have referred to himself, Rav Moshe Sofer, who lives from 1762 to 1839, and he is really the first strong opponent of reform. In the early years of reform, remember those rabbinic conferences of the reform movement in the 1840s. At that point, the Chasam himself is already dead. He passes away in 1839. The Chasam Sofer, as he was known after the name, you know how it is. Different figures take on the name of their books. We refer to different characters, different historical characters, not by their name, but by the title of their book, so that the Chafetz Chaim becomes the Chafetz Chaim after the name of his book. And we sometimes even almost forget the names of the people themselves. They become synonymous with the works they write. So Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, becomes the Rav of Pressburg, Hungary. The reform moves also to Hungary. He becomes the Rav in Pressburg in 1806. And his yeshiva becomes a center of the opposition to reform. He famously appropriates this term, or this phrase, a pasuk in the Torah, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. In a completely disconnected context, the Torah is discussing the issue of chadash. Chadash is, without going into the details of it, has to do with new wheat. There's a period of time after the wheat sprouts in which it is forbidden. There's a machloket in the Gemara. I refer to this as a pasuk. It's not a pasuk, of course. It's a statement in the Gemara about chadash, this new wheat, being forbidden for a certain period of time. Whether or not that prohibition is in effect min haTorah or midrabanan, and the Gemara makes the statement that chadash, the new wheat, is forbidden min haTorah, and the Chatam Sofer appropriates this phrase, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, to refer not to the new wheat, but to Chadash, to that which is innovative, to that which is new. The Chadash is forbidden Min HaTorah. These innovations, these reforms, are forbidden, he claims, and that becomes the slogan, as it were, of the anti-reform movement as headed by the Chatam Sofer. But of course, there's a great irony, because in the opposition to reform, in the opposition to change and innovation, by definition, to engage in that kind of polemic, which until now had not existed in the Jewish community, that very opposition itself is a davar chadash. That very opposition itself is a type of innovation. To be clear, the innovation that so riled the Chasam Sofer was changes in halacha, trying to trying to be michadesh, to innovate things that are against both the spirit of halacha, of Jewish law, as well as the letter of the law. That's what he's opposed to. Nobody, not even the most radical militant right winger, thinks that halacha doesn't adapt and that halacha doesn't have to be evaluated and applied in innovative new ways to innovative situations. I mean, think about just in the realm of technology, for example, the array of the way that we observe Shabbat, for example, is almost may have been unimaginable to people just a few hundred years ago. The advent of electricity, beyond questions of whether or not electricity constitutes a malacha, constitutes a, the use of electricity is forbidden on Shabbat or not forbidden on Shabbat, electrical devices. The very fact that we have electricity, that we make use of it, just changes the entire experience of Shabbat in terms of permitted and prohibited ways of warming food on Shabbat, lighting, etc., etc., etc. So obviously, halacha has to adapt to modern realities, technological innovations, just one example. And whenever you live, whether you live in the year 2010 or the year 1910 or the year 1810 or the year 1710, wherever you are on the timeline, you're living in the modern era. Whenever you live, you're living on the cutting edge of technological innovation. You know, it's sometimes hard to imagine. We folks might be living in an era where those innovations happen at an accelerated rate. It could be that they're constantly accelerating. I mean, just stop and think for a second how it is that we're meeting right now, all of us simultaneously from around the world, literally around the globe. We are joined here together, communicating, hearing and listening to each other, seeing each other, you know, all of us, some of us in our own lifetime, and if not in our lifetime, then certainly in our parents' lifetime. You know, the idea of making a phone call was unimaginable, certainly a long-distance phone call. And now here we are. I mean, I remember, and I'm not so old, at least I'd like to think I'm not so old, I remember the first time somebody told me about email. It was not so long ago. It was in the early 1990s, and a friend of mine said to me, "I just sent an email," and I said, "What's an email?" And here we are, meeting on Web Yeshiva. So that's a side point about what exactly the opposition was to. The idea that the Chasam Sofer was opposed to everything new is clearly not true. But it's the specific reforms to halachic practice which so riled him. But as I was saying, the irony, of course, is that the Chasam Sofer's efforts and the yeshiva itself that he headed in Pressburg itself was something new. There was an ordered curriculum of study in the yeshiva, which was something new. There was an attempt to train rabbis in public speaking, an anachronistic use of the term, but in leadership skills and those types of things, which was innovative. There were communal education projects in the yeshiva. There was an attempt in the yeshiva to reach out to balabatim, to the laypersons in the city, a type of kiruv project, as it were. I mean, that might also be a misuse of a term. But these were all innovative things. The Chasam Sofer himself was influential in the Habsburg royal court in order to try to exercise some political influence in keeping down the spread of reform. That is also another chidush, the role of a Rosh Yeshiva serving as a type of lobbyist. All of these things were part and parcel of the innovations that were introduced in order to oppose innovations of a different sort. The Chasam Sofer, of course, was a tremendously influential figure. His Torah is still studied today, of course. Anybody that spent any time in yeshiva has encountered the Torah of the Chasam Sofer. The institutions that he founded still exist in their various Gilgulim. There's a yeshiva in Yerushalayim, not far from the central bus station, which is called on the side of the building. It says Pressburg on it, and that is a Gilgul, as it were, of the original yeshiva in Pressburg. Although the nature of the yeshiva is somewhat different, but that building is the great grandchild of the yeshiva that the Chasam Sofer headed. In the German colony, some of you may know, a block away from Emek Rephaim. Those of you that aren't in Israel probably have visited at some point. I hope you visit at some point, and you've probably made your way to Emek Rephaim, which is the trendy street in the German colony in southern Jerusalem, with all of the restaurants and the shopping and all the other things. You know, the height of bourgeois Jerusalem. A block away, there's a large yeshiva called Erloy, which, if you go in there, you assume that all of these people are Hasidim, because we're kind of narrow-minded and prejudiced like this. We see people that dress in a certain way, we assume that they're Hasidim. They're actually not Hasidim. They're Misnagdim, but they are descendants of the Chasam Sofer and his circle. And the Rosh Yeshiva himself is a direct descendant, Ben Achar Ben, to the Chasam Sofer. So there's a yeshiva that's alive and well, in a rather unusual location. And you don't even know it's there unless you pass by. When I lived in Yerushalayim, nearby to there, I very often used to daven there on Friday night in Erloy, it's called, which is named after a city in Hungary. That's the Orthodox response to the Reform movement. There was a different response, sometimes classified under the term Neo-Orthodoxy or New Orthodoxy, which comes a little bit later. It comes in the generation after the Chasam Sofer. This is usually most closely associated, of course, with Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. But also with Rav Azriel Hildesheimer. I don't think we'll have a chance to talk tonight about Rav Hildesheimer. It's interesting. Rehov Hildesheimer is in Yerushalayim, which is also parallel to Emek Rephaim, is maybe 100 feet away from the building of the yeshiva of these descendants of the Chasam Sofer. So it's interesting how that works out. I don't think that there's a Rehov Hirsch. I don't think that any place in Yerushalayim there's a street named after Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, which seems strange to me. It seems strange to me that there wouldn't be a street. But I don't believe that there is. German law required that all Jews belong to a single religious community, meaning that the Jewish community be organized under one auspices. That's still true, by the way, or it was true until not long ago in England, that the United Synagogue, headed by the chief rabbi, was the representative of the Jewish people in England, in the United Kingdom. Now it's been liberalized somewhat, and the other denominations have taken on a bit of a stronger role there. But German law required that all the Jews, that there could only be one. When the German government wanted to deal with the Jewish community, it wanted one body or representative to function with. Once the reform became the most numerous, by definition, they became the representatives in Germany of the Jewish community. In 1847, the German government allowed a separate, in other words, an Orthodox minyan within the communal structures. In other words, this idea that there could only be one organized Jewish community was obviously not tenable. So very quickly, the tables get turned, and it becomes the Orthodox community that has to start lobbying for equal rights, as it were. In 1849, in Frankfurt am Main, there are two cities in Germany named Frankfurt, and they're differentiated by which river they sit on. So there's Frankfurt on the Main River, there's Frankfurt on the Oder, Frankfurt am Oder, and Frankfurt am Main. So in Frankfurt on the Main, congregation Adat Yeshurun, Adas Yeshurun or Adath Jeshurun, sometimes written in English, is formed. And in 1851, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who was then a young man, he was in his early 40s, is appointed the rabbi of Adas Yeshurun. Sometimes in America, the descendant of that shul still exists, in a shul in Washington Heights, New York, in Upper Manhattan, and it has branches elsewhere. It's now called KAJ. KAJ. They also actually do some hashgacha work. They do kashrus supervision, and their symbol on the package is KAJ, Kahal Adat Yeshurun, named after this original shul from the 1840s in Frankfurt. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch becomes the rav of this shul. He's a incredibly dynamic personality. I always say, I mean, I mentioned this last week, it's hard to tell sometimes from these pictures. Although this picture of Azriel Hildesheimer has some personality to it, but these pictures where you had to sit very still while the aperture of the camera was open for a long time, you had to sit very, very still for a couple minutes. So usually that meant people had to like just clench their jaw and stare out into mid distance, and you get an image like this one, which this is the well known portrait of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. You can't see the personality, you can't see the charisma. Everybody always looks so harsh in these photos. He was very dynamic. He's a great optimist in the face of terrible pessimism about the options for orthodoxy, for Torah true Judaism. And he formulates this notion of a neo-orthodoxy, a new image of a proud Orthodox Jew. He, as opposed to the Chasam Sofer, he formulates this notion of Torah im derech eretz, which is a Talmudic notion. It's a this phrase already appears in the Mishnah in Avot. The exact meaning of the phrase in its original context is not as important as the notion of that Shimshon Raphael Hirsch gave to it. the exact meaning of Torah im Derech Eretz has been interpreted and reinterpreted in different ways, but a notion that Torah, that a religious life, can be part of a life that also includes the larger world, that these things can go hand in hand. They're not natural enemies, that there's a form of synthesis, a form of encounter, a form of, well, fill in the blank. What that is difficult. You know that a number of years ago, 20 years ago already, Rabbi Norman Lamb from Yeshiva University wrote a book called Torah Umada. It's an important book for anyone interested in these, oops, one second. His book is called Torah Umada. I think I wrote that in yellow. Let me change the color. I'm sure you can get it on Amazon still. Why am I having trouble with the board here? One second. There you go. Torah Umada. I think it has two D's. It was originally published by Jason Aronson. Alan will post the link for us. He wrote this book called Torah Umada. Torah Umada is the slogan of Yeshiva University, which also literally means Torah and Mada, either meaning specifically science or generally speaking secular wisdom. General wisdom, and he wrote this book that outlined, there you go, thank you, Alan, Torah Umada, hold on, let me just look at that for a second. And the book outlines, I think, the encounter of religious learning and worldly knowledge in the Jewish tradition is the subtitle. I see it's very expensive on Amazon. It sells for almost $42 on Amazon. So that seems like a lot of money. But you can probably, you know, get it at a local library. A local Jewish library, that is. Or a shul library or things like that. So Rabbi Lamb wrote this book which outlined the history of different models of the interaction between Torah and secular wisdom, or Torah and general society. And he, one of the models that's outlined, of course, is from Shneur Hirsch and Torah im Derech Eretz. There were, of course, schools of thought that strongly opposed the interaction between Judaism and general culture and general knowledge, and others that were more welcoming. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch is an early advocate, at least in the modern period, certainly in the Ashkenazi world, that said that Judaism can be engaged in the world. And this is part of his attempt to create this new image of a Jew who's loyal to the tradition, but is also engaged in the larger German world. Again, after the emancipation, there's no other option. You can't, as we've said a few times, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. And when the only option was that you were Jewish, and therefore you had to be a member in good standing of the traditional community, and your only other option was to convert to Christianity, so that set very clear boundaries. After the emancipation, that's no longer true. And after the emancipation, it's no longer true. And Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch understands that there's a necessity to create an image of Judaism that can keep people in the fold and yet also accept the realities that the world has changed, and that the encounter with general society, with secular learning, with simply with earning a living, is necessary. I see that Raphael posted a link to much better priced copies of Rabbi Lamb's book, starting at $4.28. So you could also try that out there. There's one copy for sale at $4.28, and then a bunch of copies in the low $20. So that's worth your checking out. Linda writes, after the emancipation, there's a tradition that started where the challenge was to have more money and be reform, or be a true Jew and be poor or poorer. That was certainly a component of it. The economic was certainly a component of it, although I don't think that was only it. There was also a sense of pride of what it meant to be a Jew. If being a Jew meant that you were backwards, and there was an aesthetic component that was lacking, and there was a worldly component that was lacking, these were all disincentives to remaining true to Torah and to Judaism. And he makes an argument that in the encounter with general literature, for example, that it's not an outside goal, but that when you read literature, you should read it as a Jew who can appreciate the secular modern world, modern dress. I mean, it's hard to tell by comparing these two pictures, but the Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch is wearing modern clothing. In Yiddish, we call German Jews Yekis. Does anybody know what the origin of that phrase is? Well, I mean, the word Yeki means jacket, but why are they called? Why does that become the nickname? The term Yeki literally means jacket. Right, correct. So nowadays we think that the stereotype of a Yeki is somebody who's very kind of a little bit repressed, very proper, always, you know, has their jacket on. So that's a mistake to think that they're called Yekis because they always kept their jacket on. You never saw them in their shirt sleeves. No, they're called Yekis jacket because they wore a short jacket, like what we call today like a suit jacket that only comes down to, you know, shortly below your waist, instead of wearing a kippotah, you know, like the long garment of the Hasidim. So they're called Yekis to differentiate them from Hasidim or from other, even the Chasam Sofer was not a Chasid, but the traditional community dressed in a certain distinct way with the long kaftan or the long coat, the long overgarment. And the Yekis, the German Jews, dressed in modern dress, which was a short coat or a jacket. And that's why the other Jews, again, another example of your oppositional group choosing the name by which you're called, they're called Yekis, because one of their more distinct features was their acceptance of modern dress. He puts forth a notion of halachic Judaism that's in harmony with modern society. In his very well-known commentary on the Torah, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch was very prolific. Much of his writing was focused on explicating and furthering these agendas. He has a wonderful commentary on the Torah, which all of his writing, by the way, is done in German, because he's addressing his audience. But it's been translated into Hebrew and, of course, into English. His commentary on the Torah, which has a lot of very interesting Hebrew work. He's doing a lot of etymological analysis of the Hebrew language. But he also is making these kinds of larger points. So let's say there's a pasuk in Parshas Achrimos in Vayikra. I apologize, I don't have it up here on the board for you. It's Vayikra 18:4, chapter 18, verse 4 in Vayikra. Et mishpotai ta'asuv et chukotai tishmaru lelechet bahem ani Hashem. The pasuk says that you should do my mitzvot. You should keep my statutes, my chukim, in order to lalechet bahem, to walk in them. And he makes this point that everything is lalechet bahem, that everything, whatever we do, is in order to walk. When we go out, when we go out into the world, we're walking in God's commandments. The way we conduct ourselves in business, the way we interact with other people, when we walk into the university classroom to study biology or literature or history or whatever it is, everything that we do is in order to lalechet bahem, to walk in the mitzvot, in the ways of Hashem. The goal of Torah Im Derech Eretz is to produce a Judaism that more properly understands itself. The goal isn't culture per se, culture for culture's sake, but a closeness to Hashem. That's the real rub. That's the real chiddush of Torah Im Derech Eretz. It's to use Jewish culture, not Jewish culture, to use general culture as a tool to come close to Hashem, to come close to God, and not just as a type of apologetic tool by which we're trying to convince people that are tempted by the reform to say that Judaism can also be palatable, but as a way to really make a statement about how we relate to the larger world. He himself, Shem Shofar himself, is university educated in Bonn, the University of Bonn. He, in 1836, one of his early works is a collection of letters called in English it's called the 19 Letters. We're going to look at a selection from that either tonight or next time. These are 19. They're 19 short essays. Here it is, Hirsch, the 19 Letters. This is an older edition of the English version. I know that there's a newer edition that was published a couple of years ago by Feldheim. That is a new translation and a new with some kind of introduction and running commentary, which I believe is superior to this older version that I had at my disposal to Xerox from. And there are 19 short essays about topics in Jewish life and culture, and they're a type of, not apologetic, but trying to explicate, Judaism's position on a variety of issues. They're written in the form of letters to an interlocutor named Binyamin or Benjamin. It's not clear that these were actual letters. It could be that he just chose the dialogical voice of a letter writer, which by the way, many other people, have done as well. The Mor Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed of the Rambam, is actually, technically speaking, it's a letter. It's a long treatise that's in response to the questions of one of the Rambam's students of Yehuda ben Yosef, Yosef ben Yehuda. Lahavdil, C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters. Uses the same device. of these letters back and forth between a master and a student, in order to spell out certain ideas. The idea of letter writing is a you can say something in a letter. You can accept. You can take on a certain tone in a letter that you wouldn't if you were just kind of spelling out a philosophical thesis. And it becomes much more engaging. The voice, the authorial voice, is much more engaging. And insofar as he's trying to reach, the masses, the popular readers, it's an interesting device. Even think about it, even the Kuzari, which is not written as a letter but as a dialogue, Yehuda HaLevi could have written everything he wrote in the Kuzari as a standalone philosophical work. But it's so much more engaging because it's written as a dialogue between the king and the rabbi. I trust that the general thrust of how the Kuzari is set up. If not, I can address that. So that's the 19 letters, which is first written in 1836. It's a polemical work. It has apparently a profound impact on German Jewish youth. It provides a focus for an intelligent examination of traditional Judaism in the light of modernity and modern issues and problems and challenges. In 1837, he releases the 19 Letters is a small, it's a small little volume. It's each essay is a number of pages. I don't think that any of the essays are more than the longest essays, I think, are maybe 10 pages. Some of the shorter ones are only a couple of pages. In 1837, he releases a work called Chorev. In English, I think it's translated as Horeb, Horeb. Chorev, of course, being the nickname for Har Sinai, for Mount Sinai. And that's a much more straightforward philosophical work in which he is making an argument for the viability of halacha in the modern world. He has also there very many attempts to do ta'amei ha-mitzvot, to explain the meaning and the symbolism and the rationalism and the rationale of various mitzvot and rituals. He also does that quite a bit in his commentary on the Torah. So also in addition to the commentary on the Torah, he writes a commentary on Tehillim, on the Psalms. He writes a commentary on the Siddur. All of these things are, are still with us. Ezra, are you there? You getting me?
Yes,
Okay.
sure.
You see, Howard's having some trouble. Perhaps you can be in touch with him. All of these works are classic works, still used and read today. Certainly worthy of your time and attention, any of these works by Rav Shimshon Frohlhirsch. He's an opponent of the Reform in the same way that the Chasam Sofer is an opponent of the Reform, so is Rav Shimshon Frohlhirsch, but he does admit very candidly that certain external aspects of Judaism, not halachic components, but certain external aspects of Judaism do need to be reformed, do need to undergo a modernization in order to engage modern Jew, and to give him the mechanism by which to stay true to the halacha. This is certainly true for the aesthetic of public prayer. Remember, this is one of the things that the reform movement put on their was their flagship initiative to modernize the synagogue, the temple, as they called that. We discussed that last time. And Rav Shmuel Shnova Hirsch admits that the prayer service needs to be made more more of an aesthetic experience in order to keep Jews coming to shul, in order to facilitate their adjustment to modern society. At the same time, he adamantly rejects the idea that the reforms, that the halakha itself should be reformed. He agrees that there are certain external things that need to be given a facelift, but no reforms of, let's say, the basic principle. He's, of course, a strong supporter of secular education. He's also, of course, a strong supporter of patriotism to one's host country.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, Howard, we can hear you. He's a strong proponent of a patriotic commitment to one's own host community, which of course is, you know, harkens back to Napoleon's Sanhedrin and the discussion of what the Jew's role is within his host community. Is he there as a member in good standing, equal to his brother citizens, or is he just the fifth column waiting to leave? Because of this, although the Zionist movement did not get going in by any stretch of the imagination full swing in Rav Shmuel Shnova Hirsch's lifetime, the nascent Zionist movement, or the proto-Zionist movement that did exist in his time, he was not a strong advocate of, although he was, in many places, he writes very passionately about the singularity of the land of Israel. He is not a fervent Zionist, an impassioned Zionist, a political Zionist, in the sense of making an argument that the Jews should return to Eretz Yisrael in order to regain sovereignty over themselves and their own affairs. And that's consistent with the nature of the times in which he was living. I had hoped tonight to get to it, but perhaps next time we'll read this short piece in the 19 letters. You can download it from the website or from the email that went out at the end of last week, or you can email me directly if you can't manage to do any of those, and I will email the text to you. I just put the I just put my email address in the chat box. We'll read this together. In the 19 letters, there are actually two pieces. There are two letters that deal with reform. This is actually the shorter of the two pieces. And you'll see what he's talking about. It would be, I've given it away, but you know, here in Israel, it's quite popular, the notion of the unseen. In Hebrew, we call it the unseen. I don't know why we don't have a good Hebrew word for it, but in Hebrew, we call it by its English name, unseen, to give a, you know, it's like a homework assignment or a test where you give a text and you ask people some questions about the text to help them understand what it is. I recall teaching high school, giving this text out, asking the students to try to understand, what is this person talking about? What's his attitude? What's his background? What's he advocating? It's quite fresh. It's quite innovative. And it doesn't fit in with the models that we know up until now, up until the 19th century. You read it, it helps you appreciate. I mean, for us, it's a little bit passé. We are all modern. No matter how today, no matter how right-wing one is, it's a different reality. And we all live in the, you know, we are all moderns now, and our encounter with the general world can't be compared to the isolation that pre-modern Jews lived in. Even Haredi Jews today, certainly Haredi Jews that live in Chutz La'aretz, but even Haredi Jews that live in Eretz Yisrael, where you can maintain a certain level of isolation, it's simply not the same as it was in the pre-modern era in Europe. To understand that is to understand some of the innovation of what Rav Shimshon Froehlich was advocating. Anyone who considers himself any type of form of modern Orthodox Jew, centrist Orthodox Jew, whatever term you're going to choose for yourself, is a descendant of Rav Shimshon Froehlich. Is a descendant of Rav Shimshon Froehlich. That's also significant to recall. In the chat, someone asked me privately about any recommendations on bios of Rav Shimshon Froehlich. There's a lengthy biography put out by Art Scroll, actually, quite a number of years ago. Like all Art Scroll biographies, it has its disadvantages, but it's not bad. It's not bad. I think it's probably called Rabbi S.R. Hirsch or Rav S.R. Hirsch, something like that. And on the cover, of course, is that same stern picture. So next week we will... Oh, there you go. There you go. There's the chat. There you go. Yeah, by Klugman is the author. Klugman is the author. But of course, you can also read the. It's start off with the encyclopedia. Start off with the encyclopedia essays on Rav Shimshon Froehlich. Look at the Encyclopedia Judaica. Look even at the Wikipedia, and you'll find things. So next week we'll read this text, but I recommend that you read it first beforehand. And of course, if you have any questions, you can email me during the week. Laila Tov, Shabbat Shalom, all that stuff.